Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Epic Fail. And today we have with us Todd Purcell. Todd Purcell is with Alberta Business Loans, and he's going to tell us a little bit about starting your own business and some steps that you want to take. And if you have an existing business, some ways to navigate through this whole Corona thing. Todd Purcell, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Ryan?
Not too shabby. Why don't you tell the audience, too, a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do?
So I'm a lifelong Calgarian. Tried moving away for a little bit, taking a 5 or 6 year hiatus out to Okotoks, but I'm pretty sure most people would consider that Calgary as well. I've been in finance since I was 18. We won't talk about the early years, or we'll call them the dark years of finance, where I was selling life insurance. Not an area that I really ever want to get back into, especially not as an 18-year-old. That was a terrible idea. You know, when you're 18 trying to sell life insurance, you're selling life insurance to a bunch of 18-year-olds. Like, I'm still invincible. Why are you trying to sell me life insurance? Because it's cheap. That's why. Anyway.
Yeah.
So after dropping out of engineering school, after my first year, realizing that that's not the kind of math I like, I went into business school, focusing in finance and marketing, and moved on to working with my family's mortgage brokerage. I would say the last 12 years, however, our brokerage merged with another larger brokerage up in Edmonton a few years ago. But yeah, my first soiree, we'll say, into full-time work after school. I started my last semester as a mortgage broker, which really pissed off a lot of instructors because I would be taking business calls and doing applications in the middle of class. I'm like, oh, you're being a disturbance. So I have to excuse myself quite a bit. But I already knew what my career was going to be, and it was only one semester left. Easy enough to kind of fake your way through that, I suppose. And yeah, after 6 years of doing residential mortgages, I was starting to see this very cookie cutter approach and a very small box that clients fit into. And it wasn't really pushing me to really have to think that much about what I was doing. It was just very automated, repetitive, robotic. And I don't function well that way. I get bored and I start losing interest. And so I was like, I've got a degree in business and entrepreneurship. I've taken dozens of accounting and bookkeeping and budgeting and finance courses for business. I'm going to grow our commercial division. And that's what I started to do. While I'm still doing residential mortgages, I'm starting to build that commercial portfolio. My first commercial deal fell apart at the lawyer's office. And I was so mad.
Oh, no.
Because the client ghosted us. Everything was done. They had the appointment scheduled to go in to the lawyer's office. And then I get a call from the lawyer saying the client didn't show up. I get a call from the lender saying, what's going on? The client didn't show up to the lawyers. We've got the money ready to go. We were excited about this. It's a great deal. I was calling the client. The lawyer's calling the client. Lender's calling the client. No one can get a hold of this client to find out why they just disappeared. Fast forward about 3 years later, I'm at my friend's family's cabin in Invermere. And I'm reading Brett Wilson's book that he wrote during Dragon's Den, where he's talking about the deals that he did. And then at the end, he's got just this listing of all the deals that he funded through the Dragon's Den. And there's that client.
Oh.
And they couldn't be bothered to tell me that they received financing.
Oh,
Brett Wilson,
no,
through the Dragon's Den, and ghosted everybody at the last minute. And it hurt. It was a valuable lesson about taking upfront fees or get paid the time the commitment letter is signed, because that's $20,000 I will never see.
Yeah, it'd be super disheartening. Right off the get-go, you kind of make this bit of a change to your business and your first deal that you're running, and you kind of get kicked in the teeth a little bit. You know, and that's commendable that you've actually made a success out of it, because a lot of people, even to make that change, right, to go after a more corporate or to be a more entrepreneurial based clientele, is one thing to make that shift. But then to have a big challenge like that or a big setback, a lot of people are just like, that's it. I'm back to regular. I'm just back to doing residential mortgages, or, you know, I'm just, you know, this is not worth it. I spent all this time. So that's commendable that you stuck with it.
I thought you got beat up a lot with residential mortgages, a lot of competition from the banks and getting very aggressive. But after, you know, a few years of doing commercial, you feel like Rocky. And you're just sitting in the back corner going, come in, Adrian, come in. Come in. Can't see out there. You get hit a lot. You don't get paid every time you go to work. But when you do get paid, it's a decent paycheck. And yeah, I'm still tightening and tightening and tightening. Every single deal, it's like a new opportunity to find out how people are going to try and get out of paying you at the end of the day. And getting deals done, especially through COVID right now, getting deals done is getting even more challenging because the banks are taking on all this debt right now to help people, help businesses through COVID, through these government mandated programs. And then the banks are putting out the loans, BDC and EDC, government backed business lenders. BDC deals with local Canadian businesses. EDC deals with businesses doing business abroad, overseas, outside the country. They're both backed by the government. They have been mandated to insure all these loans. So the lenders, the banks are only putting out loans for, you know, unless it's a strong deal. These COVID relief programs, BDC and EDC are insuring all these, and they have their mandate of loans they have to put out. And so few weeks into COVID and all these shutdowns, I get emails from lenders saying, we're only doing this. We're not doing business acquisition funding. We're not doing startup funding. We're not doing anything unless it's perfect AAA squeaky clean business. And I was like, okay. When I find one of those.
There's not too many ideal borrowers when it comes to entrepreneurism. Right. It's there's always risk, right? There's always a high degree of risk. It's so dependent on the person and the product and the economy. And there's so many things to deal with when it comes to lending, when it comes to the financial or the business side.
I always say you got to be a special kind of crazy person to want to start a business.
Oh, yeah.
And I sit down with so many they're coming in. I'm starting a business because I want to have control of my time and freedom. And make all this money. Right. I'm like, okay. So the only difference is you're trading a boss for a client, and that client is going to be a lot harder on you than any boss ever has. But you do have control. You can control how many of those clients you take on and or not take on. So I guess there's that. But it's also something I've learned again over the years is when somebody's coming in wanting to talk about starting a new business and they've never been in business before. They've always had a 9-to-5 or some variation of a regular paycheck coming in. One of the key elements is sitting down with them and their spouse, if they have a spouse, if they're married or they have a girlfriend, fiance, boyfriend, whatever that spouse happens to be, it's important to have a sit down with them and say, you're not going to see this person for about the next 5 years. And all the money they make is going to have to roll back into the business. So you're going to be kind of carrying this household. You know, after 3 years, if they do things right, it's going to be better. But don't expect to see them for 5 years and don't ride them too hard. Set your date nights now. Go through the calendar. There's not going to be a lot of spontaneity. And don't be surprised if those date nights get canceled, because they're trying to do something for a better future. It's an investment. It's a time investment. It's a money investment. It's
sanity,
everything investment. Sanity, whatever thin shreds of sanity you have left after working for somebody else for so long, that's all getting invested. And if you can make it through 5 years, then hopefully you make it through the next 5 years. But after 5 years, your cash flow should hopefully be steady enough that you're not out there hustling as much or as hard. You don't have to go to every single networking event. You've got people calling you now. You've built up a reputation and people know who you are. Because when you first get started, nobody knows who you are. And the people who know who you are, they don't know you as this person that you just started this business for. So they don't really trust you yet. Unless you started a business in something you've already been doing for a number of years. And still, they're like, what do you know about business? So the closest people to you, they'll usually give you some slack, but they're also your biggest critics, we'll call it. And yeah, it's especially if you're getting into something completely different than what you've done before.
Oh, so, oh yeah.
If I haven't scared you away from starting a business yet, hold on.
There's a couple things that I've heard. Don't count on family and friends, right? You know, just take that instantly right out of the equation.
That's portfolio work. You'll probably get them, but family and friends demand everything for nothing. They're like, well, we're friends. We're family. Don't profit off me. It's like, I gotta pay my bills.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, don't take me for free. It's like, I'm giving you this. Oh, no. It's great experience for you. You know, it is great experience, especially right away. So yeah, reach out to your family and friends, but don't intend to make money off them. And if you're able to make money off them, you got some great family and friends.
The other one too I hear is you carry around your pink slip with you every day, everywhere you go. I'm going to choose to sleep in, or I'm going to choose to maybe go to an event rather than go meet a client or whatever. And I have seen a lot of that where it's people will sacrifice, you know, what they had before when they were working for the man versus working for themselves.
You got to have support. If you don't have the support at home, which is again why I say you got to sit down with your significant other early on and have a third party, whether it's me or your business coach. Shout out to Laura. She's really good at that as well.
She is amazing.
Family businesses and then generational transfers. Setting that up front, just so it's not blindsiding you. I feel like so many people get into business and it doesn't work out as they thought it would, or they hoped it would right away, and they're not able to draw their $250,000 a year salary that they had in their business plan because they haven't made $250,000 revenue yet. Just having somebody that's there supporting you and understands, and that you're building every month, every day, every week, every month, every year is that much better than where you were before. And then hopefully after 5 years, you can say, okay, it's kind of like having a 9-to-5 job again. Because at first it's a 9-to-9 job. That's 9 a.m. till 9 a.m.
Yeah, 9 a.m. till 9 a.m. Pretty true.
24/7.
Where do you see things going? It's a really interesting climate. I mean, and of course, there is no roadmap for this. You know, this is this whole shutdown and the effect that it's had on the economy. There's no real roadmap for it. And there's businesses that have suffered. There's businesses that have just been completely shut down because of it. Where do you see this going? Do you see any kind of bounce back? Do you see people that maybe had a restaurant that, you know, maybe they're able to start back up? I mean, where do you see it going?
I've talked to restaurant owners and or managers of restaurants, and some of them, they bounced right back up and they are doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
Others, they won't make it through till the end of this. And it's just a matter of time. And honestly, I was on a Zoom meeting with one of our lenders early on, I think back in April. They were doing a monthly Zoom meeting for their brokers on the commercial side, sharing information with them. And from what they're seeing from the businesses that they've lent money to, they were doing censuses and surveys and questionnaires and trying to gather all this data. And what they came back to us with is the average Canadian business has 30 days of money.
Yep.
That means if there's no new money coming in for 30 days, they're done. After 30 days, there's no money left. Shut the doors. And so they're scrambling in order to just keep up. And that's the average business. Now you've got the above average business that they can weather through whatever cash flow shortage hits them. The owner has tons of money from years in business. And if they want to keep the business going, they'll just invest money back in and keep the doors open. I've got a gentleman, he was a friend of a friend's father. He owns a fairly large, well, he owned a fairly large business. Now his kids have started taking it over. And I think he just has, if I remember correctly, I think he just has his factories in China left. But there was a point during, not this recession, but back in 2009, 2011, right after I got into the business, that last recession we had, I guess that was the last one, that recession, his business, he said they got it to a manageable loss of $50,000 a month. So to keep the doors open meant they were losing $50,000 a month, but that was manageable because he was able to offset it with his real estate and everything else. So there's those business owners out there. They're not going anywhere. And even if they had to support a 5-year storm, they've got the resources. Like I said, the average business has 30 days worth of capital. And then you have all the less than averages or sub average businesses. Often they're startups, so they've been managed poorly, or the owners have pulled out a lot of money through the years and spent it frivolously on cars, houses, trying to live that entrepreneur lifestyle that they want to project to everyone, that gets everyone confused about what it's like to be an entrepreneur. And yep, it's just yachts and private jets and fast cars and big houses and loose women. And it's not that. That's how you take a billionaire and make a millionaire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me buy an airline.
Yeah.
How do you become a millionaire? You start as a billionaire and you buy an airline.
Yeah, that's true. So I've seen a lot of businesses do like really good on a pivot as well, where they've taken, or it might be a restaurant. I've seen a restaurant turn into a food truck. Different businesses where they'll have their one main source of income is lost, so they totally pivot to another product that they may have. Masks, right? Masks and gloves all of a sudden are a big seller. So in the retail world, and that's something that people should be looking at, is how adaptable are you in business? That's a big thing going forward to look at, like when starting up, I think, is to be able to adapt.
Definitely. And some of the business that I have seen since this all started, one, they were making medical scrubs and other clothing. And so they just shifted slightly, got a big contract from a provincial government to make N95 masks and other PPE equipment for health services. And so they've been doing really well with that. I have another client that makes food trucks, that his business is building food trucks. And so he's seen an increase in business. Can I plug a business on here? That's not.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So if you're looking at getting into the food truck business, you're a restaurant and you want to get rid of $20,000 a month worth of overhead with your rent, $50,000 to about $120,000 gets you into a turnkey food truck. And you can reach out to Hamida and Wari with Mobile Business Express. They're based out of Airdrie. And he'll get you set up with, like I said, a turnkey business. He produces a really great product. They've learned and learned and learned over years of building the product, how to make it more foolproof. So they have shut off valves, all of their propane gas lines, everything gets shut off as soon as that big awning drops down. So they have switches on that, because a food truck, not one of their food trucks, but another food truck, I think in the States, blew up because somebody forgot to turn off the propane and then went in to light the stove the next morning. So they make sure everything's compliant with whatever province or state that you are planning on operating your food truck in. And I was concerned about the food truck industry, actually, because all the big events that normally feed food trucks, food trucks feed the people, and those people therefore feed the people running the food trucks, get canceled. But they, with restaurants closed and people still needing to eat and not knowing how to cook, they've just kind of taken off. And as you said, restaurants opening food trucks instead of having to have all that overhead.
Yeah. And I really think that the food truck industry and community has done a really great job of coming together. And you'll get these food truck meetups where they're just like, okay, we're going to have all these food trucks at this empty parking lot. And that's going to be, they're making an event of it themselves. They're now the event rather than them being a vendor at an event.
Yeah, I think Skip the Dish is now set up with so many food trucks, so they just have to go park somewhere for the day and they notify Skip the Dishes, this is where we are. So if you got a particular food truck, you like their food, you can Skip the Dishes and have it delivered straight to your home.
That's awesome. So what are you focusing on now mainly? I guess, like, if you're looking at getting into business for yourself or being your own boss or entrepreneurship, there's two different ways you can go. You can come up with a product or a service, or have an established industry that you want to move into and start your business. Or you can buy into an existing business or purchase an existing business.
That is correct. So yeah, where I've been shifting my business, I've been working on making this shift over the last 2 years, going from a broad paintbrush stroke any kind of commercial financial financing, from real estate to working capital to buying equipment and buying businesses to, I've been putting a lot of focus and emphasis on that business acquisition, mergers and acquisition model and strategy, because I see it as a opportune time to be in that field. And without giving away too much, we're coming up to a very unique time where there's all these baby boomers who have businesses that they've started and they've been running for years and years and years, and they're moderately successful to extremely successful if they've been in business that long. And baby boomers are starting to retire, and their kids don't want those businesses necessarily. Some do. Some just want to check. Some want to take on the business. Or maybe the founder of the business looks at their kids and say, I don't think you're ready for this, but I want to retire now. So we're seeing a lot of businesses come onto the market right now, or if they're not coming onto the market, they're wanting to start their exit strategy. And so when I get somebody coming into, well, not my office right now, but I get a phone call and somebody says, I want to start a business, it's my opportunity to start pitching. Well, there's all these little nuances and stresses and risks of starting a business, as I went through earlier. What if you bought a business that was already past a lot of that initial stage? Let's get started at year 5. Let's get started at year 10. You have cash flow, you have clients, you have a name, a reputation already, and go in and have the previous owner, the current owner, train you a little bit so that you can do things more or less like they were doing, so you can retain their current clients. But then now you can add your spin onto it. It's not the same as quite having a baby that you give birth to and you raise and you've got that emotional connection to, but you also got to pay your bills. And if it's feasible, why not start with a little bit of cash flow? And you always have the option down the road to change the name of the business if you want, if you don't like what the business name is, or you think there could be a better brand that you can portray to the audience you want to get into. So yeah, buying a business, if you come into my office and you say, I've got $50,000, $100,000, $150,000, and you want to start a business and you need X amount of additional startup capital, I may say, well, what can you buy for $50,000? What can you buy for $100,000? What can you buy for $150,000? And people are often surprised at what they can get into with not as big of an investment, depending on how strong they are, how many assets they have, all the blah, blah, blahs, and the boring back end stuff. With $50,000, you're probably buying about $100,000 to $150,000, maybe $200,000 business. We try and keep around 20% equity as a minimum is what we want to see. But with structuring, we can get creative in a business acquisition on what that equity looks like, as long as the seller is motivated enough and willing to do some vendor financing or some vendor earnouts, or retain even a little bit of equity in the company going forward to help that transition. So that's one of the things I go through with my clients and say, let's put together a financing structure on how you can get into a slightly bigger business. And the reason I look at getting into a slightly bigger business than one might think they can, because you can go, you can buy a business for $50,000. If you got $50,000, buy a cash. Honestly, if you don't have $50,000 minimum in the bank, you're probably not in a position to buy a business anyway, because you have to have something, some of your own skin in the game. Typically, I would hope for 100, 150, 250 or more to get into a business acquisition. But there's all sorts of businesses for sale. You can buy a business for $10,000, $50,000. So if you're buying a business that small, sometimes it's just easier just to pay cash. But I always recommend negotiate some sort of vendor financing into the deal. It just shows you how much the current owner believes in the business that they've built. If they're unwilling to provide any vendor financing, it's a no-go. Whether you need it or not, it's a red flag. And whether it's a valid red flag or not, it's a red flag. That owner doesn't believe in the ongoing business, or they don't believe in you, and they think you're going to run into the ground, and they don't want to take that risk. So take it as a red flag, however that red flag may present itself. But again, this is where I get into, how big of a business can you buy? So if you have $100,000, you can probably buy maybe up to $1 million business. And if you look at business brokers, will probably disagree with me. My finance or my valuation models are typically based on what a bank will value a business at, because that's who I deal with. I deal with the banking end of it, the banking end of that transaction. And the banks have their models, and the banks will only do so much of a multiplier based on the size of the business. So if you're buying a business that's worth $50,000, you would hope that they're doing about $25,000 worth of profit a year, or $50,000 worth of profit a year. Most small businesses, somebody tries to sell you a business with a 6x multiplier and profits $10,000 a year, step away from that business, buy it for the assets, come up with some other structure, because it's not worth $60,000 unless it has $60,000 worth of assets. But in a larger business that's doing $5 million a year, 6x multiplier isn't necessarily unheard of. That's not $5 million worth of revenue. That's $5 million worth of profit. Now you can push, because you also have to think that multiplier is how long is it going to take you to pay off the loan you have to take, so that if you were to pay cash into that business, how long is it going to take me to get my money back? If you paid cash on a 6x multiplier and you did nothing else, you just bought it as a portfolio piece, leave it running the same way it is, hope it's not going to go down in business. It's going to take you 6 years before you make a dollar. So think about it that way. But if you've got that kind of money to buy a $6 million business at a 6x multiplier, and you know, you're probably going to be running between 4 and 6 on a business that size, depending on industry and everything else. Don't quote me on that, because there's sometimes it can go for more, sometimes it'll go for less. So it really comes down to each individual business.
Yeah, each individual case. Now, I think I am a super creative person, and I've been told this as well. And you know, when I first thought about, you know, buying someone else's business, like you said, you know, it's not, you feel like, oh, it's not your baby and whatnot. However, I recently changed my mind on that. And with buying someone else's business, it's sort of like jumping into their marketing department, right? It's like, hey, I can maybe take and make a spin here. I can do this or that. Of course, being careful not to alienate the existing business, right? You don't want to take all their clientele and throw them to your competition. But at the same time, you know, buying a business doesn't necessarily mean that there's no creativity in it. You can still, there's different directions you can take it. And it's something that's already established and already making money, rather than starting from complete scratch. With some of my other friends that have been thinking about opening up businesses, they'll say, oh, geez, like, where would I even start? Right? So right there, if there's already maybe an existing coffee shop or record store, maybe not.
but you're dating yourself now. Yeah, I'm going to get into the record business.
Vinyl's making a huge comeback, or has been making.
Vinyl is. And you know, you're going to get a very certain type of clientele. You're going to have a lot of DJs in there, and you're going to be looking at this DJ walk in, and they're like, oh man, yeah, this is a great, it's an original Beatles crosswalk album, whatever it's called. Someone's probably going to call me out on that.
Yeah.
I'm not that old.
Yeah.
And you're going to be like, oh, yeah, this is an amazing album. And he's like, oh, I'm going to scratch it. And then you're like, just kind of holding on to it. Like, no.
Abbey Road,
yeah. So, yeah, they're going to come in and you're like, I'm going to do things to this album. And he's like, no, please, no.
Yeah. But even just like the sound, there's like a lot of audiophiles, people that are like so specific with the sound that they want out of their music. So they'll just play vinyl.
Well, it's led to some new genres. If you want some unique genres, that's what you're into. My wife has gotten me into this because she really likes that lo-fi sound. It's kind of created its own lo-fi jazz hop genre. So if you put into the YouTuber lo-fi jazz hop chill hop, you get this really lo-fi sound, and it sounds like you're listening to an old vinyl record, and it's got a really cool sound to it. And there's some artists out there that are doing some amazing stuff in that field right now. It's great. Just you want to work either, there's some that they just set a great tone for just doing business, and there's some if you've had a really stressful day and you want to relax, there's some amazing music within the genre just to sit down, chill out on the deck with a beer or wine or glass of scotch. Buying a business does not mean you're not being creative. It just means you want to be creative in a different manner. Like you said, go into their marketing department. You want to go in and choose what hat you want to wear instead of having to wear all the hats. Hey, I'm a marketing guy. This business has an operations manager already. It has a controller or a bookkeeper, depending on how big the business you're buying is, might have a CFO. But you can place yourself where your skills lie and take an income right away. Or if you want to have the real entrepreneur experience in buying a business, don't take the income and invest it back into the business and grow that business even more. So if you're looking at a business that you're buying and say, I can pay myself $60,000 a year if I buy this business, which, you know, you're getting a lot of people excited right now. I'm talking about $60,000 a year. You're making about the average income, maybe a little bit higher. But if you took that $60,000 and just increased your marketing budget with that instead for that first year, maybe the first couple of years, maybe you can now draw $120,000 after 2 years with it.
Yes, it was saying that, like, if you had an established career and you wanted to buy a business, or you were independently wealthy and you wanted to purchase a business, and yeah, just throw that money right back at the business. Can you imagine what kind of positive effect that would have if you were throwing the money in the right places versus the previous owner that maybe depended on an income?
Depending on an income, or I've seen them where they've gotten to a certain point and they don't need the amount of money they take out, but maybe they do. Their lifestyle is a bit more lavish than it had been. Where I've seen business owners pulling $1 million, $2 million out of their business on an annual basis. And I looked at one business. Oh, it should have been worth $20 million or more. And that's just the business, not including land, not including the building. Could have been worth $20 million or more. The building and the land were appraised at just over $3 million. He was trying to sell it for $7 million, and we were struggling because he didn't invest in the financial part of the business. He knew how to sell his product. He knew how to sell it. He had revenue coming in more money than he knew what to do with, and he didn't know what to do with it, so he didn't do the right things. And a business that size, if he'd invested $20,000 extra a year to his financials, he could have gotten his $20 million. Easy. But instead, he was scraping, trying to find a buyer that could arrange financing to buy it for $7 million. And half of that was land and building.
Oh, jeez.
Because when it comes to businesses, and this is a lesson to learn for any business broker out there and anybody looking to buy a business, if your business is doing $2, $3, $4, $5 million worth of revenue a year, you think you can sell it for $1 million or $2 million. That's kind of that starting point. If you're not operating on review engagement financials, and so those who aren't familiar with what a review engagement is, they're your basic level of financial reporting, which most businesses have. And it's prepared by an accountant. It doesn't have to be prepared by an accountant. There was a notice to reader, or you'll hear it referred to as a compilation. The accountant or bookkeeper is just taking the information that you've provided them. They run your amortizations and what you're allowed to write off on an annual basis. And they add that into the numbers and compile it all together, but they don't do any due diligence, or they don't have to do any due diligence on the numbers provided. So it's really accounts taking you for your word for it, and therefore the bank has to take the account's word and your word for what's in those financials. No one's looked at them or done any significant looking into them. So the bank doesn't like those on larger loans because the account's not willing to sign off and say, I trust the financial reporting in these documents. A review engagement, however, it's not quite an honest. So they're not looking at absolutely everything. But an accountant has, and you have to be an accountant now to do a review engagement, I think it'll be the CPA or higher, a CA, which doesn't really exist anymore, but any CAs that got grandfathered long, they can do a review engagement set of financials. And if you're doing a couple $1 million a year or $5 million a year worth of revenue, and you think your business is worth over $1 million, and you do not have review engagement financials, you've just eliminated a huge amount of potential buyers from buying your business because they can't get financing on it. Unless they're putting on a $1 million business without review engagement financials, that buyer now has to come up with about $750,000 down to get financing on the last $250,000.
Ooh, that's tough.
That business to me is not for sale.
Yeah, that's not for sale. Yeah.
The seller now has to do a huge amount of vendor financing because the bank is only going to give you $250,000, maybe if it's strong enough, $350,000 against that business. And if the buyer comes in with a decently strong down payment, 20%, 25%, even 35%, the bank's only giving 35%. So now that additional 30% has to be made up somewhere. And if you can't buy a business with 35% down, that business isn't for sale. Yeah. And if it's not profitable with 35% down, it's priced too high.
That's the other side of it, yeah.
I'm going to preface it. That is my opinion. Other people have different opinions. I'm not a certified business valuator. My valuations, like I said, they just come from what the banks look at for valuation internally. So if it can't be profitable and you can't pay your bank loan with it, then it's probably not a good buy. Unless you're coming in and you know exactly how you're going to change that business, you're going to make it more profitable. But my thought there is, why pay somebody a bunch of money for something you're going to do? So if you were buying a house to flip, would you pay the current owner of that house post-flip value after, like, you've done all your rent, you've put $100,000 worth of work into this house, are you going to pay the previous owner $200,000 extra because you're going to put $100,000 in? No, you're going to pay him what it's worth today. And I think that's where a lot of business owners that have gotten to the end of the road and they think their business is worth so much more than a bank is going to value it at. And they're stuck looking for a perfect buyer, a cash buyer that is either, how do you say this nicely, less educated, or somebody who hasn't done the due diligence, isn't planning to do proper due diligence. You're looking for that unicorn that way, or you're looking for a different type of unicorn, which is a larger company that is coming to buy you out and take you out, which is the other field that I work with right now. Is I work with some larger companies or larger groups that have been in the business. Maybe they're a $5 or $10 or $20 million business and they're looking to acquire some smaller businesses. Don't count on them to buy you, because if you don't have their specific criteria, they probably won't buy you, or the offer they're going to make is not going to be more than anyone else is going to make you. But if you meet their criteria, yeah, a larger business might give you a little bit more, because they can create a lot more value. But that's the strategy that I try and teach to people getting into it. Start with a slightly larger business than you thought you could. If we can get you into it through some vendor financing. So let's go back to this. What can you buy for $100,000? I said about $1 million business, because you need about 10% of your own money into it to buy the business. So if you're sitting there thinking you've got $250,000 in the bank and you want to go buy a business, you could potentially buy a $2.5 million business. Would you want to? Maybe, maybe not. Because you want to have some cash flow, but that can also be worked into the deal as well if the seller is willing to work with you on that. So let's say a $2.5 million business. Maybe let's scale back to $2 million. You have $250,000, but you don't want to spend all of it. You want to keep $50,000 as a retainer or for whatever else may come up, or you're going to keep that to pay yourself so you can invest more into the business. So you're buying a $2 million business. $2 million business should have an EBITDA calculation. I'll tell you what EBITDA is in a second, of at least $500,000 a year. So EBITDA, for those who are unfamiliar with the term, because there's going to be a lot of industry jargon as you get deeper and deeper into buying a business, is earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. So it's your adjusted profit. A business broker, I don't want to throw business brokers under the bus, but they all do it. They take the owner's income that they're paying themselves and they're adding that back in and saying, well, the owner's been taking $100,000 a year. So on top of EBITDA, the owner took $100,000 salary, $200,000 salary. So we can add that back in because that's money that you can pay to yourself to therefore service this debt. Without getting into too many issues with what is involved with that, I call that a half truth. I look at that as extraordinary losses or gains. So if current owner's paying himself or themselves $200,000 a year, you have to look and see what the owner does and who do you need to hire to replace that owner. So if I was looking at this as a straight investment, I want to put my money in and pull a return out. I don't want to touch this business at all. I'm an investor. I'm Warren Buffett on a small scale. You want to be Warren Buffett. I'm sure a lot of people want to be Warren Buffett. I'm sure there's people that are like, nah, he's evil or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, for those who want to be Warren Buffett, you want to put your money in and then put your team to work. So you have to figure out how much is your team going to cost. So if you're going to do that method and the current owner's paying themselves $200,000 a year to run this business, and they're the operations manager, they're the marketing team, they're the guy in the field, they're everything. Well, guy in the field's $40,000 to $50,000. Operations manager, $60,000 to $80,000. The marketing team, if you're to hire a marketing person, let's say they're just to deal with your social media, they're unfortunately pretty cheap. You might be paying somebody minimum wage, to so $30,000 to $40,000 a year. And all of a sudden, all this $200,000 add back, I got to take it out again, because you've got to hire somebody to do all those things. And that's how it has to be looked at. You're buying a business. You're not buying a job. And that's how I want people to think about it. You're buying a business. You're not buying a job. And, you know, you're going to want to pay yourself something out of it as well. Maybe it's a modest paycheck you want to take out. You're putting $200,000 down. You want a 10% return on your money. So you're going to take 20% of $20,000 out on an annual basis for your return on investment. Cash on cash investment, not including, because you're going to have the business pay your debts that you accumulated, you know, your bank loan to buy the business, your vendor financing to buy the business. But you're not putting your time in. 10% return seems reasonable. Maybe you want 20%, so you're taking $40,000 out of the business. You want 30%, so you're taking $60,000. It's a reasonable amount for not having to do any work in the business and a good return on your money. So in a few years, you're actually getting your investment back. You haven't lost any of your time. You're still doing what you're now. You're the jet setting. You're not jet setting on $60,000 a year, but you've got some actual freedom of time with this business you bought. Or if you want to go into it, you can pay yourself a little bit more. What I use is a Google search, and you type into the Googler, what does a operations manager of a tire and lube shop make in Calgary? And you'll see a bunch of things. You'll see like Workopolis and all these job search websites come up. And then you're going to see something called payscale.com. And they all kind of give you an idea, because all these companies, they're based on advertising jobs, what jobs are available. And so they'll tell you roughly what a range for that job in whatever city you want to search it in pays. A low end, average, and high end. So you can say, all right, Mr. Seller, Mrs. Seller, you're taking $200,000 a year because you built this business, whether it's through T-Ford salary plus dividends and bonuses and whatever you're paying yourself on an annual basis. But to replace you, I need to pay somebody $80,000 a year. So let's add your $200,000 salary and dividends back into that EBITDA calculation. So we're increasing the profit by $200,000, and then we're decreasing it by another $80,000. And now you're getting a more accurate picture. And I can sell that to a lender in normal times. I can sell that to a lender.
In normal times, that's the caveat, yeah.
In COVID times, that's a no-go, because they want to be a little extra careful right now, because there's going to be a lot of businesses going out of business due to COVID.
Which may be opportunity for somebody to jump in. And sure, you know, whether it's exploitive or whatever you may call it. I mean, if it's just somebody that wants to buy maybe a little restaurant, it's their passion project or whatever, you know, maybe they're not looking to make a whole lot of money right now with it. And I say, okay, you know, I'm willing to kind of suffer for my first 5 years or first couple of years because of the whole COVID thing. But it might be a good opportunity to jump in or even partner with somebody. Or
I would suggest the partner side. So when you talk about restaurants, I'm dealing with somebody like that right now. They want to buy a restaurant. Unless you're perfect, don't buy a restaurant right now. This is not the time to be buying. Like, if you want to look at, so I was going to say this quote earlier. People have probably heard it. They may or may not know who said it. The time to buy is when there's blood running in the streets.
Yeah.
And you're going to see a huge wealth transfer, because there's blood all over the streets right now. Like, it is. It's not running. It's flowing through the streets at the moment. That's Baron Rothschild.
Yeah.
That. So, you know, the patriarch of the Rothschild fortune. And if you're not familiar with the Rothschild, do a quick Google search. You're going to see a lot of yeah. weird stuff.
Yeah, you'll see a lot of crazy, crazy things.
You'll see Mr. Burns in human form.
Yeah.
And you're going to see a lot of conspiracy theories. But the time to buy is when there's blood running in the streets. And right now there's blood all over the streets, because there's businesses going out of business. There's people going bankrupt. And that makes it an opportune time to buy. But at the same time, if you don't have the cash to get into the restaurant business to float you through what's going on right now, because you're going into reduced capacity, you're not going to be at full capacity, and we don't know when you're going to be able to get to full capacity. But if you're going in and you want to have like a skip the dishes or a lot of delivery and focus on delivery, fantastic. You've got a massive patio, fantastic. You can get a bunch more people onto the patio, but it's still reduced capacity what you would normally have due to social distancing and maximum of 6 at a table. You're not getting big groups in like that. There's still money to be made there. The restaurant industry is not an easy industry to get into, and most people that get into it go bankrupt fairly quick because they don't market properly. They don't do their grand opening properly. They don't have enough working capital. If you're going to pay, and the lease rate on restaurant space is not cheap. A cheap restaurant lease on a couple thousand square feet is going to cost you $17,000 a month or more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's $17,000 a month. And a decent restaurant should be able to fairly easily pull in $20,000 a week in revenue. So let's say you're at $80,000 a month. Hopefully, kind of at the low end, 20,000 roughly. Let's just round it up. 20,000 goes to rent. 20,000 at least is going to staffing. That's half of your income. We haven't even talked about the 15, 20, 25% for your food cost to get that. So now, basically, $20,000 is going towards your food cost. You've got $20,000 left, and now you've got insurance to pay. You've got your own salary to pay. You have all the other overhead. Probably a business loan to pay out of that. And it reduces your profit down to almost nothing. So $20,000 a week in revenue for a restaurant is more or less break even, plus or minus a couple thousand dollars.
Yeah.
Now, if you can run fairly lean, you can maybe make a little bit of money with it. You know, you'll probably be doing okay, but it's not going to be a lot to set aside some extra cash for when you've got your slow period, which is inevitable to come.
Especially with the uncertainty too. You don't know if everything's going to be shut down again and you don't know where things are going. Saying that, though, where do you see things going with Calgary? There's a massive change because we have, you know, haven't touched on oil and gas, but everybody knows where that is. but what do you think either a Calgary should be looking at getting into as a sector, or what do you think is going to be the next budding thing for Calgary?
Well, since our last recession in 2014, 2015, we really never came out of it leading into COVID. I've been thinking Calgary needs to be back into tech. We've got brilliant people. You talk to the resource ministers of Alberta, and they're like, we're a resource province. And it's more or less been, you come to Calgary, and you come to Alberta and make your fortune, and then you go back to wherever you came from. Because being a born and raised in Calgary, my parents weren't both born and raised in Calgary. My mom was, but my dad was born in BC. You don't get a lot of people who you meet who are like, oh, you're born and raised in Calgary? You're a Calgary native? And you don't see that a lot because everyone's from Ontario or Newfoundland or BC or somewhere that's not Calgary, somewhere that's not Alberta, because everyone comes here to make their fortune and go back to wherever they originally came from or wherever they want to go after that. It was kind of a rape and pillage model. Make your money in the gold rush, whatever type of gold you're going after, and then go back and spend your money somewhere else. And because we have so many resources, if you live in Calgary, you might not believe it. If you've lived your entire life in and around Calgary in the prairies part of Alberta, you might not believe how many trees we have in this province. But there's a lot of trees as soon as you go north of Edmonton.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we've got a great forestry industry there on top of oil and gas. So, you know, forestry can pick up a lot more. And oil and gas and forestry should be working together a lot better than they do, but they don't. We have farming, obviously agricultural, so those can always take a step up. Marijuana, cannabis is starting to fill in some gaps as well as that becomes a bigger, call it a budding industry.
Pardon the pun. Yeah.
I'm definitely intended. But yeah. I really believe as far as a big sector goes, that's been kind of abandoned is that tech sector. And that's because we have a huge amount of tech companies. It's just all of that tech has been revolving around oil and gas, mining tech, oil and gas tech. How do you become more effective and more efficient? And actually the downturn in the oil and gas sector did create a tech spike for oil and gas tech, because now all these companies that are laying off all these employees needed to find a way to keep the doors on and become more efficient. And honestly, with technology, it's the tech exists long before it's utilized, because you need a catalyst for that tech to be implemented. So the catalyst is either, we saw in fast food and actually restaurant chains, your catalyst is minimum wage increase. Minimum wage increases, all of a sudden, technology's there, like McDonald's, next day. And now it's a $15 minimum wage. The tech is released into McDonald's. So you got a big iPad sitting there, and now you can select. And now they only need people in the back and one person working the till. We'll call it the Luddites like myself, who still want to talk to a person. Or you go to the grocery stores and they've got the express checkout lanes, which are no longer express checkouts manned by somebody in 15 items or less. No, it's a computer. Then you can scan your own stuff. You know, you don't get a discount to use that lane, but the business now doesn't need to hire as many cashiers to push through more business. They just need one person there for when inevitably somebody like me goes through and they mess it up and they need to go and reset it.
Yeah.
So that's in kind of a small minimum wage scale, what happened there. But you look at the oil and gas, because I remember I was seeing a bunch of friends that I have or people that have acquaintances in the oil and gas sector laughing at all these minimum wage McDonald's employees getting their job replaced by a computer. And then the recession happens and their jobs, their $250,000 a year job driving truck up north got replaced by a computer. You have self-driving heavy-duty equipment in the oil sands. They don't need all those drivers anymore. Those jobs no longer exist. Now you got to go and get educated so you can do repairs on those trucks. And it's not repairing a normal truck. It's mostly a computer. So you have to go get a computer science degree to go get a job up in Fort Mac, whereas you could drop out of high school. It's not as common, I think, now in Calgary, but I know, chatting with my wife who's from Edmonton, a lot of people, they don't get through grade 12 because they know they can go make a six-figure income up in Fort Mac, could make a six-figure income by going up to Fort Mac and working on the rigs. And now those jobs are being replaced by technology because the margins are not as big as they were at $100 barrel. And I don't think I wouldn't rely on getting to $100 barrel for Alberta's economy until the reserves are actually running quite low. But that kind of, what is it, like $50, $60, $70 barrel that we've been seeing as of late is, I think, if you can't be profitable on that as an oil and gas company, get out. And that requires efficiency, that requires technology, and that requires not having a bunch of overinflated salaries. And the industry has done really good at releasing tech to combat that. But again, it means that those jobs don't exist. So that means there needs to be something else to pick up those jobs. The people losing those jobs need to go get computer science degrees so they can go get the jobs that are being created in the industry. And therefore, we have kind of everything leading towards tech. Now, we are a leader in mining tech, but we need to be a leader in other tech, because we have, especially if you look at Calgary as a whole, we've got one of the youngest cities in the world, or the youngest city in the world. Our average age, our median age of somebody in Calgary is 36 years old. So we are a young city, because everyone who's made their money, they're off to Kelowna when they retire, or they're off to Salmon Arm maybe if they didn't make as much money, or they're off to Invermere, or they're down to Phoenix, or they're down to Florida, or they're down to Mexico. We don't retain our old people. They don't live here anymore. They come back for holidays. They're off to somewhere warm once they retire. So we have a very young city with a lot of college degrees, university degrees, a ton of engineers, a ton of computer scientists. We have all these brilliant people, but no jobs for them, or less jobs for them. And they all are very well suited to go into the tech sector. So I think we utilize that human capital. Edmonton, probably more medical based, because they have the U of A there and they have a great medical department there. They're one of a few places that has a Gamma Knife, which is a really cool instrument. I'm not a master on Gamma Knives because I didn't go into that. I'm a finance guy. But it's basically like two laser rays, and where they intersect is where they cut. And you can touch either ray as long as they don't intersect, and it's basically harmless. So they don't have to actually cut people open. They can get this little thing inside your body without cutting you open, because it only does anything where the two beams intersect.
Oh, that's madness. That's cool.
Right? And they have one at the U of A. It's also not a cheap instrument.
No.
Medical tech, huge up in Edmonton. Any kind of other tech, we can have huge down here in Calgary, and everyone else in between gets to benefit from that. and we could have a very booming tech industry if we could just get money for it. And with the last election, provincial election, any incentives that were created by the previous government for the tech industry or any other industry to come to Alberta got eliminated, and we doubled, tripled all in on oil and gas. They like to say energy sector, but I don't think it's really energy sector. It's oil and gas. And this is where the two governments, if they could just agree, or the three governments, throw the Liberals in if you want, if they could just agree on something, it'd be don't get rid of your current income until you have it a new income.
Yeah.
Which is the problem that the NDP went after. They started getting rid of the old before they had anything new to replace it. But they at least had their eyes on true diversity for Alberta. They wanted to bring in more industry, more employers, diversity, and not just give everything to the oil and gas sector, which is what we typically do.
Mm-hmm. Like we talked about earlier, being able to pivot, right? And, you know, just as an individual business should be able to pivot, I think a geographic location or, like, you know, the province of Alberta, or even just, you know, if you look at Calgary, should be able to pivot in whatever industry. We're a beautiful city. We have tourism. We're not quite a BC. Yeah.
I think we have the better mountains. BC has hills. You can go to BC. They say they have the mountains. Jen has some family or close family friends that live in Vancouver. And they were out here one year for Christmas. And they're like, Alberta doesn't have mountains. Alberta doesn't have mountains. BC has the most beautiful mountains. Like, hold on. BC has hills. Your trees go all the way to the top.
Yeah.
Alberta has mountains. We have rock. You can look at them. There's snow on them pretty much year round. Alberta has mountains. When you get to the continental divide, they stop becoming mountains pretty quickly after, and you've got trees all the way to the top. I say, if you've got trees to the top, you've got a hill.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you.
It's a big hill. They have some great big hills and some amazing rivers and lakes and trees and everything, but they're not mountains.
Yeah, but they're not the mountains.
That's maybe my Alberta bias coming out.
Yeah. Hey, trust me, if we're talking about Alberta bias, there's no bigger supporter than me. Saying all this, so somebody's just been listening to this episode and they're thinking about starting up their own business or purchasing into a business, the first step would be obviously
call me.
Come and talk to Todd. Where can we call Todd Purcell?
So you can call Todd Purcell at 587-437-9252. If you can't reach me there, you can try me on my alternate number, 587-439-9252, just because I needed a second line.
Just, you're like Batman.
Like Batman. Some people ask if that's personal in business. No, it's business and more business.
There you go.
You can email me at todd@albertabusinessloans.com. You can email me at todd@toddpurcellmortgages.com.
So, all right, Todd Purcell, thank you very much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Until next time, stay epic.
Thanks again for listening to Epic Phelan. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe. Give me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Real Ryan Phelan, and visit my website at thecalgaryrealestateguy.com. Until next time, stay epic.